Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
What city is this?
One of the four inquired. Frank had difficulty guessing the speaker's gender with any certainty. Its clothes, some of which were sewn to and through its skin, hid its private parts, and there was nothing in the dregs of its voice or in its willfully disfigured features that offered the least clue. When it spoke, the hooks that transfixed the flaps of its eyes and were wed by an intricate system of chains passed through flesh and bone alike to similar hooks through the lower lip were teased by the motion, exposing the glistening meat underneath.
I asked you a question.
Do you understand?
The figure beside the first speaker demanded. Its voice, unlike that of its companion, was light and breathy, the voice of an excited girl. Every inch of its head had been tattooed with an intricate grid, and at every intersection of horizontal and vertical axes, a jeweled pin driven through to the bone. Its tongue was similarly decorated.
Do you even know who we are?
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, I guess you've been reading Clive Barker, right?
That's right. Yes, our cold open was a passage from the 1986 novella The Hellbound Heart by Clive Barker, which he himself adapted and directed in 1987 into the horror film we all know as Hellraiser.
Oh, wait a minute. There was just 1 year gap in between writing the novella and making the movie?
Yeah. Clive Barker was on a roll in the late 80s. Like he was, I mean, he's still on a roll. He's one of these creators that really has not visibly slowed down.
What's that Stephen King quote from that year? He said, "I've seen the future of horror and it is Clive Barker."
Yeah, quote the king. I think that quote was actually in the trailer for Hellraiser, the film.
As was, "I am pain."
Oh, no, I think he doesn't declare that he is pain until three or possibly four.
I'm imagining a future crossover sequel. It's like Jetsons meet the Flintstones, but it's Judge Dredd meets Pinhead, and they just alternate back and forth with "I am the law" and "I am pain."
Well, that actually sounds like a great matchup. Uh-huh. I would be a little surprised if it hasn't been done or at least pitched, because Judge Dredd is thrown down with like Alien before, mm-hmm. and I think he's met Batman.
Well,
Pinhead's been in a number of comic books.
You could see the more nuanced side coming out of each, because you discover that in small ways, Judge Dredd is also Pain, and Pinhead is also the law.
Yeah. So I want to, you know, wax nostalgic for a moment here. I didn't get into Hellraiser movies till probably 1995 because I was too young for them, really, prior to that.
Wait, how old was that, though?
Oh, don't make me do math, Joe. But I was like in junior high or so in 95. And by that point, the first three films were already out, and Doug Bradley's Pinhead was already cemented as a horror icon.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's up there with, like, Freddy and Jason at that point.
Yeah, like, in the 1994 Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episodes, the Shining episode.
Oh, the Shining is so good.
Pinhead is one of the horror icons that drags Homer out of the refrigerator.
Oh, yeah.
Who the walk-in freezer.
Ones? It's like Jason, Freddy, Pinhead, and then just some werewolf or something?
I think so, yeah. It's like a quick scene. But like already by that point, I think it had been decided that this creature, this entity, had a role in the Halloween pantheon of Hollywood.
So you read the book before you saw the movie?
I think I read the book after I saw the movie.
Okay.
I remember reading it on a school trip. It's short. It's a novella. But it was really impressive at the time. As our cold open illustrates, it has a slightly different feel. It's the film Hellraiser is essentially the Hellbound Heart. It is Barker's own adaptation of it.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are differences, and one of the key differences is this character of Pinhead, the Hell Priest, whatever you want to call it, is just called Lead Cenobite in the first Hellraiser, the role played by Doug Bradley. In the novella, it has a slightly different flair to it.
Yeah, I was reading some things about the production, and it seems to me that the reason Doug Bradley's Pinhead became such an icon in the movie had to do with the practical necessities of filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
Again, it was something about like character, like the other Cenobites that appear in the film would have been given more dialogue, but their makeup effects didn't allow it.
Right, because you have like the Chatterer and the Butterbean Cenobites and
the Butterball.
Butterball, yes.
Butterbean.
Similar appearance.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, that makes sense. The makeup prevented them from speaking.
Mm-hmm. And Doug Bradley could speak, though he couldn't walk around very well, apparently. He had these black contact lenses in that made it hard for him to see, and he was afraid of tripping over the skirts of his Cenobite robe. So he didn't move very easily, but he could talk, and so he could say things like, "Save your tears. It's a waste of good suffering."
Yeah, he has a very commanding voice, whereas in the original novella, the character that would become Pinhead is described as this excited girl. And the Cenobites themselves come off as grotesque in their own way, but they're more androgynous for starters. And then there is this sense that they are not as demonic as they are just otherworldly. Like they have lived in another realm of the senses for so long, and that they just don't have anything in common with human sense perception anymore.
Right. They are explorers that go beyond the boundaries of pleasure and pain. And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about today when we get to the science portion of today's episode. But I know you're not done talking about Hellraiser, right?
Oh, no. And I do want to just remind everybody, as far as the Hellbound Heart goes, you can find it for yourself on Amazon or wherever you get your book in all formats, including a $1.99 ebook and both an audiobook production and a full-blown like audio play production. So you have no excuse not to go in and grab a copy of it if you want to check it out. I also highly recommend the Books of Blood. There's some really great short stories in those collections. I've always been a Clive Barker fan. I haven't read everything he's written, but there's just an unmatched creativity there, both on the written page, but behind the camera and visual art as well.
Just before we came in here, I was having a conversation with our colleague Ben Bolin of Stuff They Don't Want You to Know and Ridiculous History, and he was asking what my favorite Clive Barker was, and I had to admit I have not read any. For some reason, just never gotten into Barker. He was very surprised because he knows I like horror fiction, but I don't know. For some reason, I just never went there. It may be because when I first saw the movie Hellraiser, I think this was like my freshman year of college, I found it actually very depressing.
Yeah.
I found it it was full of interesting imagery. I thought it was actually kind of original and imaginative. But something about the world it pictured seemed very bleak to me. It was like a world where nothing is good and everything goes to hell and there's nothing to care about.
Yeah, it's a bleak, brooding film. And I can see why I was especially into it as like a brooding junior high student and as a, you know, a teen.
Right. Spoke to you then.
Yeah. I mean, then also it felt, you know, it was a cool way to rebel, I think, too. Because like Stephen King, I was super into Stephen King at the time. And Stephen King can certainly be you know, graphic. But Barker always felt weirder, more counterculture in a way that really resonated with me. And, you know, there's probably no better way to push back against small town Southern Baptist upbringing than to turn to the explosively creative worlds of an openly gay British horror writer.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I will say it is, despite its flaws, I mean, I will talk about how I just rewatched the movie and it did not match up with my memories at all. I found it rather funny upon rewatching it, especially a lot of the line delivery by the Cenobites and its over-the-top ponderousness. there was a lot of unintentional laughter. But I will say it is still a pretty imaginative concept. It was like very original for its time.
Let's now that we're speaking on Pinhead's voice in the movie, let's have a quick splash from the trailer.
We'll tear your soul apart.
That's just a sample, though, because most of the original theatrical trailer is screaming.
Okay. Yeah, so I guess should we briefly discuss the plot of the movie?
Yes, and for anybody who hasn't listened to a movie episode we've done before, we will get to a lot more science and interpretation of this particular cinematic installment. But first, we do need to remind everybody about what's up in Hellraiser, because it's easy to forget, especially if you've seen a lot of the sequels. And if you've seen some of the later sequels, then truly, God help you. But the original plot line goes like this. Do you have a creepy uncle? Well, did your creepy uncle ever, say, have an affair with your mom and then use an antique puzzle box to open a dimensional rift in your grandma's house, summoning a weird sect of transdimensional Cincinnats in your uncle's quest for new extremes of pleasure? Well, that uncle is Frank Cotton. And yes, he's dragged away to the realm of the Cenobites of the Order of the Gash, and after a while manages to escape in a much reduced state and works out a plot to reclaim his body. And that's essentially the plot line of Hellraiser.
Right. So you got your core elements of this mysterious puzzle box that is just a normal kind of cube with some paintings on it. Mm-hmm. But if you manipulate it in the right way, press here and turn there and that kind of stuff, it starts opening up.
Right.
And then once it opens up, a familiar series of events unfolds where lights shine in through, you know, cracks in the walls and stuff. Chains with hooks at the ends of them shoot out of the walls and grab you. And then the Cenobites show up. And they're these people usually with like shaved heads or just generally weird heads.
Yeah.
Usually something has happened to their head. They're wearing black leather robes as if they're a combination of they're sort of like S&M priests. And they show up and they're like, okay, it's time to take you away to a dimension beyond sensation. It's time to experience pain and pleasure indivisible.
Right. Yeah. And they're very much, there's a boundary confusion with them, right? Because they're both ghastly and beautiful in their own way. They're erotic and grotesque at the same time.
Yeah. And the suggestion, I think it's explored much more in the book, is that these creatures they're part of some weird, esoteric, other-dimensional religious order that worships the exploration of the extremes of sensation, right?
Yeah.
And so they've gotten to the point where they can no longer tell the difference between pleasure and pain. It's just sort of like experiences to the max all the time of whatever valence possible.
Yeah, it's more, it's not like I'm going to pull your skin off, blah. It's more like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm rude, I'm being rude, I should pull your skin off. I should be a good host. This is the natural thing to do.
Yeah. Though I feel like that, I think that's more there in the book, which again, I haven't read, but in the movie, it does come to feel more like they're there to punish you sometimes. Mm-hmm. I don't know if this conceit about them just being sort of experimenters is really consistent in the films.
No, I mean, even in the first film, which is certainly the truest to the original source material, even in that, you can tell that that Barker is leaning more into the idea of them as movie monsters, though it's still Clive Barker's movie monsters. And Clive Barker is one of those creators who has always loved his monsters most of all, you know.
Right.
But still, even in the film, you know, the Cenobites are not the most important aspect of the plot. They're not the central antagonist. Even our heroine, Kirsty Cotton, and her father, Larry Cotton, aren't as central to the plot as Frank, the individual we've just described, the uncle, and Kirsty's mom, Julia. It's ultimately about their dark love affair that ultimately transcends the boundaries of life and death. You know, they're the characters at the heart of all this, and they're the ones whose desires we most understand and even on some level sympathize with, even though they are, you know, dark, desperate, and depressing characters.
Yeah, I think the deal is that Frank is just this guy who's seen it all. He's had every hedonistic pleasure of the flesh possible. He's beyond good and evil. He has no morality left. Mm-hmm. He's just trying to seek the next highest possible sensation, and he's usually got a knife out because he's just that kind of guy.
Right. And then Julia, on the other hand, played by the excellent Claire Higgins in this, she's, you know, by and large, the best performance in the film.
There is one scene where I don't know if they did this on purpose, but the way they did her makeup and her hair, she looks exactly like David Bowie in his Aladdin Sane persona.
Oh, huh. I didn't notice that. I'll have to look back at it.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's wonderful in it. And in a same way, her character is also like trapped in a life of tedium and boredom.
Mm-hmm.
Like her husband is this boring guy who watches boxing on television, and she just seems to be, you know, putting up with him.
Uh-huh.
And so thus comes her attraction to Frank. And even when Frank comes back from the dead in this, you know, grotesque body, you know, she still ends up helping him.
Oh, and of course, helping him involves like killing a bunch of people.
I think so.
He can. It's not exactly clear. He can basically drink their blood and thus reconstitute his original body.
Yeah, it's a little vague, and I like that it's vague. You know, uh-huh. You're not really sure exactly what the necromancy is of all this, but that is the thing. Frank is essentially a necromancer,
mm-hmm.
and has these powers. Yeah, looking back at the film, it's you really can't overstate the importance of Frank and Juliet. They are the core of the film.
Mm-hmm.
They are its main characters, and they are its main monsters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Cenobites show up mostly in the third act as a kind of almost as a kind of deus ex machina.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is fitting because they are literally coming out of the machine, right?
Yeah, deus ex boxina.
I'll tell you a few other things I want to say about the film, just rewatching it. The music is fine. It's a bit dramatic. But I've long wanted to see a cut of it with the original score by post-industrial act Coil. This was the late Peter Christopherson, who was also in Throbbing Gristle, and the late John Balance, who was also in Psychic TV. So they had conducted the original, put together the original score for the film. And the replacement score that's more traditional and cinematic was supposedly a condition of additional funding that Barker received in order to finish the special effects in the film. So my musical tastes lean far more Coil than they do traditional cinematic score. So what I've heard of it, it sounds really interesting. So that's one thought I have on it. Coil, if you're not familiar with them, they were a big influence on the likes of, say, Trent Reznor. And of course, Clive Barker was also an influence on Trent Reznor as well.
Yeah. I'd say Nine Inch Nails is pretty thoroughly Cenobite music.
Yeah, especially the early stuff. Let's see, what else about this film? Oh, the costumes and the practical effects, I think, hold up very well.
Yeah, they do.
And I think this is definitely a film where you look at it and I'm impressed by just how ambitious it really was, perhaps overly ambitious, especially given the small budget and the fact that Barker was, you know, adapting his own work here, directing it as well. And this was he'd done some screenwriting, but he had not directed anything previously. And it's really, you know, they go for not only they have the Cenobites in there and all these effects, but also like a regeneration scene and additional demon monsters that, you know, if you were being like maybe a little more careful with your budget, you might say, well, do we need this monster? We already have this monster.
Uh-huh.
Maybe we can actually cut two whole monsters and two big practical effects from the film and use those funds elsewhere. But still, it mostly comes together.
I'm not quite sure the purpose served by the monster that's referred to as the engineer, which doesn't look anything like an engineer. Instead, it's like a big sort of larva that crawls down a hallway with a scary mouth on the bottom part chasing after people.
Yeah, it's that's something that the engineer is mentioned in the novella, but it's more it's like a being of light or something. It's mm-hmm. it's not a monster. So that like that, I feel like comes off a little confusing in the picture. Like, what is this and how is it connected with everything?
Now, I don't want to rag on the film too much, but I will say that one of the things that was funniest about it to me is that Pinhead, even in the first movie, I mean, I think it gets even more like this as the movies go on. Mm-hmm. Pinhead gets increasingly Freddified. Like yeah. he becomes like a wisecracking, you know, making jokes at the camera, kind of Freddy Krueger character. But even in the first movie, almost everything he says is this like threateningly pretentious kind of line that could be a quote on the VHS box cover.
Oh, yeah.
It's all stuff like, we'll tear your soul apart, or the box, you opened it, we came. Mm-hmm. Or, of course, the inimitable I am pain.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like Freddy, he has a lot of catchphrases and sort of quote-ready samples. And I've heard of him in a number of different DJ mixes as well, throwing a little Pinhead, right? Mm-hmm. But he also reminds me a bit of 90s pro wrestlers in that regard,
oh,
you know?
Yeah.
He's like The Rock. He has The Rock's, I guess, more post-90s. But still, you know, he has his catchphrases that he lashes out with.
You can imagine Macho Man Randy Savage saying, "The box, you opened it, we came."
I actually just learned that Doug Bradley serves as the authority figure in the indie British occult-themed wrestling promotion Blackcraft Wrestling.
I don't know what that means.
look it up. It exists. Uh-huh. It's like clearly he's doing kind of like he's not in a wrestling ring. He's like showing up like they're doing a green screen thing and he's, you know, making matches and whatnot. But mm-hmm. it's Doug Bradley being Doug Bradley.
But like he officiates a match by saying, "Your suffering will be legendary, even in hell."
Now, I will say that I think it's by the fourth one, he does have a line about pain that I think is actually pretty good, where he says, quote, "What you think of as pain is only a shadow. Pain has a face. Allow me to show it to you."
Allow me to show it to you.
And like that line, I think is pretty good. Like he gets at some of the intangible aspects of pain, how difficult it is to understand another individual's pain or relate your own. Mm-hmm. But of course, this is from Hellraiser Inferno. Then he goes on to say, "Gentlemen, I am pain," and he kind of ruins the moment. You know, he kind of goes a little far. He can't help but go for the catchphrase.
"Ladies and gentlemen, I am pain."
So, in summary, this is what I'll say about Hellraiser. It's a film that I have a lot of nostalgia for, mm-hmm. and having rewatched it in the past week, I'd say that more things work than don't work, mm-hmm. and that it's still like it's astounding that everyone was able to put this film together. And then ultimately, like clearly it resonated. Even though like my personal taste, I like the Cenobites of the novella more. Mm-hmm. Like Pinhead worked. Like Pinhead became a staple. Like Pinhead is part of American popular culture now.
A couple years ago, I went through the process. I don't know why I decided I needed to do this, but I watched all of the Hellraiser sequels. I don't think that's a journey people need to go on. There are fleeting pleasures throughout them. Like Part 3 has some pretty funny stuff. Mm-hmm. Part 4 has some funny moments.
Part 3 is kind of like peak Freddy Hellraiser. Like where they realize like, oh, this is what we've created. We've created this horror creature that mm-hmm. the masses are into. Let's give him the film that this character deserves.
Of course, Part 4 is Pinhead Goes to Space, which is, I don't know, it's hard to sniff at that.
Yeah, that film is notoriously a mess. But then it also just has so many like, crazy things in it, it's hard to completely dismiss it.
I kept wanting to see, I think I may have said this on the show before, but Rachel and I have frequently talked about how there needs to be a crossover, again, franchise crossover, but not with Judge Dredd. This should be Hellraiser and then the Air Bud sequels, mm-hmm. they cross over. So you've got like Golden Retriever puppies and they're playing with the box and it's called Hell Buddies. And so the Cenobites come out and they're ready to do all their hooks and stuff, but then they're conquered by the cuteness of the puppies. So it's like, I am,
All right. Well, on that note, let's take our first break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about puzzle boxes.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back.
All right, so we know that Hellraiser starts with a mysterious puzzle box. It's this box that it can be opened, but how you open it is apparently not obvious. And people just fiddle around with it until they figure out the secret, and then they end up unleashing the hooks, the chains, the Cenobites, and so forth.
Yeah, the first film and all subsequent films, there are generally going to be some scenes with somebody fiddling with the box. And it doesn't seem to – it seems to adhere to unreal physics, which is fitting. It is a magical box. It opens a magical doorway through which magical beings then enter. So, you know, I don't take any issue with that. at all. But of course, in the idea itself is just irresistible. We love myths about boxes that should not be opened, or the idea of a box that resists opening is also tremendous as well. An enclosure born of human ingenuity that must be solved via human ingenuity as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's a wonderful conceit for opening a story like this, that there is this thing. It requires effort. It suggests that there's kind of that there's a beyond normal amount of interest, right? People seek out this box when they're bored with all of the sensations of Earth, and they want to go beyond. They want to see what other level they can reach. They have to find this secret artifact.
Yeah, and you know, ultimately, I think we all have puzzle boxes like that in our lives that we're trying to unravel, right? But one of the interesting things here is that, of course, Clive Barker's not just creating this out of nothing. He's drawing on inspirations. One of the inspirations is clearly, you know, especially I think they flesh this out a little bit in the fourth film, playing on the tradition of philosophical toys that captivated audiences in the 18th century. And we've talked about some of these on the show before, like the pooping duck, various automatons, wind-up clockwork devices that don't really do anything. I mean, they don't, you know, fulfill a purpose. They do things, but those things that they do are merely to amuse us or to make us think about, you know, the biomechanical nature of the world, or God as a clockmaker, that sort of thing.
Sure, a machine that poses a question.
Yeah, and they're also testaments, of course, to the creator's talents. Mm-hmm. How could someone so gifted with machinery make a musical box such as this?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's another legacy of boxes that he's drawing on, and that is the puzzle box, particularly the puzzle boxes of the Victorian period. And I have to admit, I really wasn't familiar with these at all. Like, even, you know, having seen the Hellraiser movies, I never looked into anything beyond, you know, the wind-up clockwork stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a tradition of woodworking trick boxes, puzzle boxes, and they're pretty phenomenal. So one example I came across from said to be from the year 1900, is a wooden book money box. So it looks like a book that you would have on a shelf, like a hardbound book, but it's made out of wood. If you pick it up, take it off the shelf, you see that there's a coin slot in the top of it. So it's not being too secretive, like I put money into this. But then how do you get the money out? Well, to do that, you have to know the trick. And these older trick boxes, generally there's just one way to do it. So on this one, you slide part of the book spine aside, and that allows you to slide another little panel, and that opens the box and you can get the money inside. It's clever, you know, kind of the woodworking version of the various clockwork marvels that we were discussing earlier. But then it ends up coming into its own in the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's during this period that you have woodworkers both in Europe, particularly in England and Switzerland, but also in Japan, that really begin pushing the boundaries of what's possible with a wooden puzzle box.
Yeah.
And the Japanese puzzle boxes seem to be some of the most impressive. They typically look like ornate wooden boxes with no visible hinges or lids. And then they may require as few as 3 or more than 100 moves to open. So like sliding this little panel. Like, first of all, finding the panels to figure out like what is a piece of wood that moves here, and then sliding it to the side, sliding something else to the side, doing all these little tricks in order to open up the ultimate interior of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And this was according to Woodsmith Shop, which is a video series from Woodsmith Magazine. Episode 1204 is on YouTube. These guys, Chris and Phil, host it.
Yeah,
and
I'm sure they're going for the Hellraiser audience, by the way.
Yeah, they're exactly what you might imagine when you think of like sort of I'm guessing like Midwestern. Woodworkers, they show off one of these boxes, and the craftsmanship is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Like woodworking, I feel is an area that I often take for granted. Like I see a finished piece of furniture, be it something from IKEA or something you know more robust, and I don't really think about all the skill that went into making it. And perhaps that's why things like wooden puzzle boxes exist, to show you just how much skill is involved in turning raw wood into something that serves a purpose.
Well, there's something counterintuitive about it, because we don't usually think of woodworking as being concerned with moving parts.
Yeah.
Most stuff in woodworking is, you know, design and crafting of static elements, maybe with very few moving parts or something. Maybe there's a hinge or something on a cabinet. But these combine elements of course, the kind of beautiful static art and design of woodworking with the kinds of interlocking mechanisms you'd more often see in machinery and metalworking.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, you know, I can describe them a little bit, but I really, you should look up some videos of people manipulating these boxes. And then hopefully, you know, get your hands on a wooden puzzle box of your own, because there are still people making them. There's an individual by the name of Kagan Sound, that's with a K, K-A-G-A-N-S-O-U-N-D, at kagansound.com. You can look him up. He's apparently one of the foremost wooden puzzle box makers in the world. And he's something of a modern-day Le Marchand, if you will.
Oh, wait. Well, that's from the fourth movie, right? We find out that the creator of the box is somebody named Le Marchand.
I think it's also revealed in the novella.
Okay. Yeah. It's the Lament configuration or the Le Marchand box.
Yes. Yeah. There are also people that are apparently making puzzle boxes out of Lego blocks, which makes sense. Now, some of you might say, well, hey, how about the Rubik's Cube? Erno Rubik's 1974 invention. I would say –
Well, like if you do it just right, it opens up and there's something inside?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't have an interior. So it's not – it's a puzzle cube, not a true puzzle box. There is no inside to the Rubik's Cube. It will not open up new realms of pleasure and sensation.
No, that's not true. If you solve it, you get all the faces solid colors. Hooks shoot out of the walls. It's how you get the hooks.
I should also point out, though, it's not always completely clear in the Hellraiser books that the Lament configuration has an interior either. But there are shots in the film that establish an interior to the box, and its interior is described in the novella. So
there are scenes in the movie that I can imagine would have worked a lot better in fiction when you didn't have to see them staged. And one of them is the scene where the box is solved in order to fix the problem.
Right.
You know, where the Cenobites are sent back to their realm because – Kirstie Swanson, like, does the right things with the box. I mean, it just looks funny when she's messing with the box while the house is falling apart and Pinhead is saying, no, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. It's the problems of translating the novella to the film. Because in the novella, the box is also not described as being really ornate either. Mm-hmm. It's really more in has more in common in the book with these wooden puzzle boxes we've described.
Hmm.
Now, here's another area to consider. So the box of lament is largely positioned as a thing that must be solved in order to open a gate, to reveal a secret. But we probably shouldn't forget that the Cenobites are also presented, especially in the novella, as explorers. And there's a sense of curiosity to them. They're truly spaced out on sensation, you might say. And so I'm wondering, might we consider the lament configuration as a means of exploration as well? Because certainly puzzle boxes are used in various animal studies by scientists, typically with a food reward at the center. I believe we've discussed the sorts of boxes in the study of corvids,
mm-hmm.
Where there'll be like – generally, you know, there's food in the middle of the box. There may be some tools, or they have to make their own tool, what have you. But they have to come up with a way to free the prize from the box, which is ultimately what Frank's trying to do with the lament configuration.
Uh-huh.
Now, another noteworthy puzzle box from science history is Thorndike's puzzle box. This is the work of an American psychologist who was working at the same time as Pavlov in the same area, you know, looking at animals and their problem-solving abilities and their behavior. And he used this on cats in particular to test their learning and problem-solving abilities. They're essentially cages that can be exited by performing the correct task, hitting the right mechanism, et cetera, in order to step out of the cage and get your food.
Mm-hmm.
And his main observation from all of this was that a cat would behave erratically the first time you put them in the box, the first time they were in there for the experiment, but then they would learn. So in subsequent experiments, they would waste less and less time in the box. They would just realize like, oh, I'm in here again. I push this button, then I get out and I can get my food. And then Thorndike's work would lead to another noteworthy box, Skinner's box, in which the animal has to engage a mechanism in order to be fed within the box,
mm-hmm.
The work of B.F. Skinner. So later installments of the Hellraiser franchise explore to some degree the idea of the box as a place or thing that may contain us, but for the most part, not so much. But the idea of the puzzle box as a means of exploring human desire, I think that's kind of an interesting idea to consider.
Well, it makes me wonder if the box is also being used to test us somehow. If it is being used to test us, then to test the humans that, you know, play with it, obviously, the people doing the testing would be the Cenobites, mm-hmm. right? So maybe we should turn to the Cenobites and think a little bit about pain, experience, sensation, and flagellation.
Absolutely. All right, so let's just start with the word Cenobite, because this really gets into a lot of what we're going to discuss here. A Cenobite is merely a member of a religious group living together in a monastic community. There are plenty of Cenobites. Technically, there are plenty of Cenobites in the world today. And they have nothing to do with the Hellraiser movie.
If you've never seen it written out, it is not spelled like Cinnabon. it is C-E-N-O.
Yeah, the word apparently emerged in the 15th century, and it comes from the late Latin coenobita, if I'm saying that correctly. Basically, you have the Greek coin, coen, plus bios, life. So it basically means the monastic life.
Hmm.
Now, one obviously does see certain levels of self-inflicted pain, however, in monastic history.
Uh-huh.
So religious rites of flagellation or bloodletting can be found throughout Christian, Islamic, Hindu, Buddhist, Native American, and other religious rites. We've covered some of these on the show before. There are plenty of religious rites of pain that can be found in the world and in human history, just as there are various secular rites of pain that can be found today within the realms of, say, performance art or even BDSM. For instance, the later of which served as partial inspiration for Clive Barker, and likewise Barker's work wound up influencing BDSM to some degree as well.
Oh, that's not surprising. So I was looking around, for more historical ideas about pain and pleasure indivisible, as Pinhead says they explore. And I came across a book by the American psychologist James H. Luba, who lived 1868 to 1946, who focused a lot of his work on the psychology of religion. And this book was called The Psychology of Religious Mysticism. And in this book, there's a part where he's in the middle of a section about narcotics, consciousness, and mysticism. And Luba begins to discuss the idea of pleasure in pain or enjoyment in suffering, which is a major theme of this movie and of the novel. And his hypothesis is that, quote, the apparent paradox of people seeking and enjoying pain becomes intelligible when one takes into account the passion for vivid consciousness.
Mm.
And so he, of course, this is in the context of religious experience. So he mentions members of self-flagellating Muslim sects, of the, quote, painful ascetic practices of the yogi, or the violent dancing frenzies of the Mænads. He says those, quote, all may yield a sense of new or increased life. Now, what does he mean by that? Well, he explains further by quoting a letter from Gotthold Ephraim Lessing to Moses Mendelssohn, in which Lessing writes, quote, "We are agreed in this, my dear friend, that all passions are either vehement cravings or vehement loathings, and also that in every vehement craving or loathing, we acquire an increased consciousness of our reality, and that this consciousness cannot but be pleasurable. Consequently, all our passions, even the most painful, are, as passions, pleasurable." Which is kind of interesting. I'm going to explore more in a second, but that I just realized that made me think of a passage in The Brothers Karamazov that's all about a character talking about the pleasure one takes in taking offense. and I remember being like, wow, how have I never read this before? Uh-huh. It's so true that like – In getting mad about something unfair that has happened to you or somebody who's been mean to you or something,
mm-hmm.
there is so often this feeling of like almost joy in the way that you get worked up about it.
Yeah, and there's a difference too. Like there's righteous anger. There's a situation where like if you feel like you've been wronged and you're having been wronged is a part of a larger problem in the culture or in the world, then yeah, you can get in this area of righteous anger. But I think more what you're talking about here are the petty things in life, you know, where it's like the server at a restaurant doesn't bring you your appetizer first.
Right.
And
I've been wrong.
Yes.
And you just start getting excited about how mad you are.
Yeah. And on some level, like, you're probably not thinking, oh, I feel so alive. I'm so angry at this server. But in a way, that is happening.
So what does Luba think is going on with these passions being pleasurable even when they're painful? He writes that it's because these heightened states of awareness and passion triggered by pain offer an escape from a sort of baseline form of consciousness characterized by tedium, insensibility, and normal fatigue. Thus, for some people, normal states of consciousness become so boring, so exhausting and tedious that the self-infliction of pain actually unlocks a state of mind that is to them preferable by contrast. And this becomes an important distinction. In Luba's idea here, it's that religious ecstasy in the self-infliction of pain is not actually an enjoyment directly of the pain itself, but an enjoyment of a kind of rapturous and highly aware state of mind that's brought about by the infliction of pain. Quote, not the pain nor the wound does the martyr enjoy, but the exaltation that comes with the quivering of the flesh.
Ah, the quivering of the flesh.
Oh, you're a fan too? So it's interesting. I'll come back to Hellraiser in just a second. I mean, first I would point out that, of course, this is in the sort of like William Jamesian cast of like broad observational psychology. It doesn't necessarily mean he's wrong, but it does mean that it should be thought of more like interesting philosophical writings based on observations rather than conclusions derived from rigorously controlled experiments.
Right.
But again, not to say he's wrong. It's just that it's not really science by modern standard. It's more like philosophy and cultural criticism. He could be onto something there. And I do think those observations may be onto something. It's funny that it lines up so well with the character of Frank in Hellraiser, a man who, again, in the movie, we see a couple of scenes of him appearing disgusted by normal hedonistic pleasure, like all of the regular pleasures of the flesh that seem to have – they failed for him. They don't work anymore. Everything's boring. So according to Luba's framework here, it could make sense for him to join a self-flagellating order devoted to the mortification of the flesh because maybe pain will unlock higher states of conscious awareness and excitation that he wants to reach – but for which the bridges of normal pleasure have collapsed.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a solid read on Frank's character for sure, you know. But also Julia is the sort of flip side to that coin. She's the tedium side of it. She lives this life of boredom and perhaps some level of contempt for her boring husband as well, and ends up being sucked into this world of intense sensation as Frank has.
But I think in all this, one thing we get to is that it starts to become complicated to try to define and understand pain, I think. Because when you ask, what is pain? It's something we all know about. You know, there's no debating whether there is such a thing as pain. But when you try to come up with a rigorous definition of it that applies to every case, that becomes difficult.
Oh, I think it goes back to that quote from the Hell Priest himself. What we think of pain is a shadow, but pain has a face. But actually, like for us to actually define the lines of that face, it's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And a huge part of that, and this is something we've talked about on the show before, is like the difficulty in even discussing pain. Like I can talk about my pain. You can talk about your pain. But it becomes very difficult for us to properly understand each other's pain and properly relate it.
Yeah, and there are some contexts in which I think it's simpler than others. Mm-hmm. But even in the simpler ones, say like regular nociceptive body pain that you would feel in the context of getting pricked with a needle or something in a clinical setting. Even then, if we look to like best approximation type answers within the medical world, you can get definitions like this one, which is cited by the International Association for the Study of Pain. Quote, pain is an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience that is associated with actual or potential tissue damage or described in such terms.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's kind of complicated. It's got multiple clauses in there. But also one of the things that's difficult about that, you immediately hit a snag with the idea that pain is explicitly and necessarily described as unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And this very definition would – of course, I think that would apply to most cases. I mean, most cases when people say they're in pain, they think of that as bad and they want it to stop, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, part of it is the problem with our language. For instance, in yoga, I practice yoga, and something that's often touched on by the teachers is the distinction between discomfort and pain. Mm-hmm. Like you should work with discomfort. Like discomfort is part of the practice. But if you are feeling pain, then that means you need to back off because you don't want to go into that third area of injury, of damage.
Right. But a lot of times it can be hard to tell the difference between discomfort and pain. I mean, are they distinct classes of things, or is that a gradient with, you know, them being at two different sides of a scale? And of course, the very definition that says that pain is necessarily unpleasant would seem to rule out the existence of pleasure in pain. It would either mean that nobody actually does take pleasure in pain, and I think lots of anecdotal evidence would seem to disagree with that, right? Or that painful sensations that bring about pleasure are not actually technically pain, but in that case, what are they? What would you call them?
Oh, I mean, as a great man once said, pain don't hurt. So what are we to make of that?
Okay, so you quote Roadhouse, and he said, but I think that position in a way is incoherent. Mm-hmm. He says pain don't hurt, but then he spends the rest of the movie trying to prevent the villain from inflicting pain on people.
It's true.
I've got a real beef with Roadhouse.
But I wonder if that quote, like part of it is that what he's trying to say is that for him, physical pain does not have, at least in this case, an emotional context. But I think it's in a way, it's like a lot of things in Roadhouse, like maybe it's accidentally clever because because it is getting at that distinction. Like for human beings, pain is both sensory, like purely sensory, but also it has this enormous emotional context.
Right. Yeah. Pain is a physical sensation. You know, there's nociception in the nerves in the flesh, and so it detects something that is an injury, could indicate an injury or something like that. But then it also is a motivation. It triggers avoidance behaviors.
Yeah, like in the yoga example, for instance, like the pain is there to tell me, hey, this thing you're doing to your arm is not in your normal practice.
Yeah.
You should be aware that if this continues, worse things could occur. Injury damage could occur. Again, that's normal functioning, not getting into disorders of pain. But again, yeah, for humans, pain is a complex topic. Physical sensation, but also this emotional realm as well. And there are seemingly dimensions of pain that are beyond the scope of less cognitively advanced organisms. Not saying animals don't feel pain, but other animals do not necessarily have this emotional context to their suffering as well.
Yeah, certainly not in the same way. I mean, you can see that a painful stimulus might cause a retreat or avoidance behaviors in, say, a crab. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to believe that a crab has the full spectrum of human, like, fear and emotions that you would get from feeling a painful wound.
Which raises an interesting question. Would a being more cognitively advanced than a human being have a greater potential for suffering and pain? And maybe would that explain something about the nature of many gods and myth and legend?
Oh, I mean, this shows up in existing works of theology. I mean, I think it's something that's often used to develop the Christian mythos, mm-hmm. which is, of course, has a big theology of the suffering of God. It says that God came down into human form, was crucified on the cross in the form of Jesus Christ, and then descended into hell for 3 days and then was resurrected. And in order to emphasize the immensity of the sacrifice, Christian theologians often point out that this isn't just like a human suffering, it's God himself suffering. And since God's state of holiness and perfection was already infinitely greater than a human's, it follows that when he descends to suffering and death, that suffering is infinitely greater of an insult than it would be to a normal human.
So the parts of our brain that respond to pleasure also react to sensations of pain. This also further complicates things. And the line between the two is sometimes a bit of a blur. For instance, a 2013 study from the University of Oslo found that, quote, the brain changed how it processed moderate pain according to the context of what the alternative was. If the pain was less than anticipated, then the brain transformed the sensation into something comforting or even pleasurable. Likewise, there was a 2014 study from Northern Illinois University that linked sadomasochism, the altered states of mind that can be obtained there, linked them with those states of mind you might achieve through yoga or meditation. You know, which I think a lot of that makes sense. You were talking about like just a feeling alive in the moment of sensation, mm-hmm. Be that sensation, you know, painful or pleasurable. Like there is essentially a built-in mindfulness exercise to that, in the same way that if you focus on your breath, you are living entirely or at least more so in the body than you are normally. Likewise, if you you accidentally prick your finger, you are living in the moment of that finger prick. Like there's probably not a lot else on your mind in that single instance.
Oh, in fact, this actually comes up in the study I want to talk about in a minute that has to do with how pain has been shown to alter or mediate our perception of our identity.
Oh, excellent. This same 2014 study, the researchers, they suspected that pain inflicted in consensual sadomasochism alters blood flow in the brain, particularly to the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which plays into our ability to distinguish self from other. As such, intense pain may result in feelings of oneness with the other individual or with humanity or the universe, which is interesting to think about.
That is really interesting. I mean, that gets back into stuff we talked about in our episodes on psychedelics, of course, with the sort of self-other distinction that is sometimes dissolved by changes in brain chemistry. But of course, we know that not all changes in brain chemistry have to come from ingesting chemicals from outside the body.
Right, right. I do want to underline the consensual aspect of that study. They are talking about consensual acts of sadomasochism here.
Oh, of course, yeah. Now, I figured it would be worth talking about other interesting scientific research that offers complications in our understanding and experience of pain. One thing that I came across that was really interesting to me is something that is known – it's a cognitive heuristic known as the peak end phenomenon.
Hmm.
And so this is a psychological memory bias that says that people don't, in their memories, mentally characterize an experience by taking an average of the entire duration of the experience. Rather, they mentally characterize an experience according to memories of a couple of little things, and they tend very often to be moments of peak intensity of the experience and then the final moments of the experience. And this has been found to apply to both pleasurable and painful experiences. Of course, not all experiences. No psychological phenomenon applies to everything, mm-hmm. but to a lot, in which it very often has strange consequences. It's been documented a lot of times now, but one important early study is by Daniel Kahneman, Barbara Fredrickson, Charles Schreiber, and Donald Riedlmeyer, published in Psychological Science in 1993, called When More Pain is Preferred to Less, Adding a Better End. So in this study, it was pretty simple. You got two test conditions that both induce pain. Again, like most studies or pretty much all good studies, this is going to be non-threatening pain, but it will be uncomfortable.
Right.
And what it is here is plunging your hand into cold water and holding it there. So in test one, you plunge your hand into cold water, which was 15 degrees Celsius, and you hold it there for 1 minute. And then in test two, you do exactly the same thing, plunge into the 15 degree Celsius cold water, hold it there for 1 minute, but then you also have to hold it for an additional 30 seconds as the temperature in the water is gradually slightly increased, though it's still cold, more cold than is comfortable. A majority of people, a significant majority of people, chose when they had the choice to repeat one of the two tests, chose to repeat the second test rather than the first, meaning they'd rather the discomfort go on longer if the final moments of the discomfort were slightly less intense. And other studies have found versions of this in different contexts. It does seem that we are willing to experience more pain or discomfort for a longer period of time if the last few moments of the pain are not as bad. And this seems to suggest that there is some way that as we form memories of painful or unpleasant experience, those memories can be formed in such a way that objectively more pain, chronologically measured, seems like less pain, because the ending of it wasn't quite as bad, and the ending seems to matter the most to us.
Well, this also makes perfect sense if you think of pain as the signal warning you about something that may happen, mm-hmm. about, you know, continued stressing of this particular muscle or continued exposure to a dangerous element such as heat or cold.
Oh, that's very interesting. I'd seen it mainly interpreted like what's causing this. The main interpretation I had seen had been recency bias. Of mm-hmm. course, you know, we tend to again, there are two things. It's the peak intensity of the experience and the end. So focusing on the end of the experience, it would be the recency bias, right? Is the things that happen more recently seem more salient to us. But that also makes sense, especially for registering pain, because pain is a lot about what could happen. It's supposed to be giving you warnings that are useful information in order for you to protect your body.
Right. But then again, at the same time, as we were discussing and we'll continue to discuss, human pain is complex. So there are other elements that I guess may skew that sort of thing.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So that's an interesting possibility too. And I should note that, of course, like a lot of psychological phenomenon, the peak end phenomenon doesn't always apply at every instance. But it's a general rule. It seems like we follow this an awful lot. But if more pain, objectively measured, seems in our minds like less pain – at least in retrospect, then what is pain? Like, what is the real pain? What is the real thing that we want to try to lessen and avoid? Or in some of these rare cases where people are taking enjoyment in pain, mm-hmm. what is the kind they want to experience? More pain in the memory or pain in the moment sensation, since those things don't always necessarily match up?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, this is the kind of thing that I feel like this happens anytime we look at pain or you really think about pain, is that it seems like our language of pain is severely lacking. Like we just don't have the proper vocabulary to get at all the different nuances here.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it raises all kinds of questions. Like I mean, even for yourself, if you're not trying to make a judgment for other people, mm-hmm. assuming pain is something you want to avoid in this context, would you rather have less pain in the moment or less pain in your memory of an experience? I really don't know how to answer that.
Right. I mean, this is the total human dimension of pain, like the memory of pain.
Yeah.
And this is the kind of thing that, certain animals are going to have to deal with. Certain animals are going to have to deal with to some level, but humans and pain and memory and the ability to mentally time travel back to that pain and then to likewise imagine encountering that pain in the future, like that defines so much of what we do.
Absolutely. Now, I've got another study to talk about with pain, but should we take a break first and then come back?
Let's do it.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
All right, we're back. We're continuing to spin off of Hellraiser and the Hellbound Heart and discuss the nature of pain.
Pleasure and pain indivisible, as the Cenobites would say. So one study I came across that I thought had some interesting bits in it was called The Positive Consequences of Pain, a Biopsychosocial Approach by Bastian, Jeden, Hornsey, and Lechness from the Social Psychology Review in 2014. And here, this is a big review article, so it's like looking at existing literature to collect examples of ways that pain has been documented to have some positive effects. And of course, you can't list all of them, and maybe some of these are better held up by evidence than others, but these are the things that the broad categories that they found some evidence of. One might be pretty straightforward, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Pain often enhances subsequent pleasure. By providing a contrasting experience, pain causes people to rate pleasurable experiences in the aftermath of the pain as more pleasurable than they otherwise would.
Yeah, like an example of this that ties in directly with some of the methods used in these experiments is that if you go to certain saunas, there will be a cold water pool, like a chilling water pool in which you may immerse all or parts of your body. And then once you've overcome with the displeasure of that, then you may go and climb into the hot tub. And then the hot tub will be more pleasurable for the discomfort that you have had in the cold tub.
Yeah. I don't know to what extent this plays a role in the mythology of the Cenobites, because it seems like they're sort of pursuing pain for its own sake in some cases.
Right.
Like they're not always following it up with a nice sauna or something.
Well, yeah, we never see them just giving a nice gentle back massage.
Right, yeah. The hooks shoot out, the hooks, and then it's like, but then after that you get to go have some ice cream. Okay, another thing from their list is they say there's evidence that pain increases sensory sensitivity. It sort of increases our sampling rate of sensations from the physical world. In some cases, this can be good.
Yeah, I mean, this makes sense, right? If your body is receiving or resonating with the signal that something is potentially damaging the body, then it makes sense that sensory awareness is also ratcheted up in order to take in what may be harming the body.
Right. Another one they point out, pretty interesting is that pain sometimes blocks or alleviates our sense of guilt, which could otherwise prevent us from experiencing pleasure. Robert, I think you had some details on a study that looked into this, didn't
right.
you?
Yes, I do. This is a study. This one came before the other one. This is from 2011, but it's also from Brock Bastian, the lead author of the other study.
Uh-huh.
A real Hollywood leading man name. it sounds like an action hero. So basically, Brock Bastian of the University of Queensland, Australia, set out to understand, what's going on with pain in this situation. Bastian's team recruited young male and female test subjects under the guise of a mental and physical acuity study. The researchers asked the test subjects to write a personal essay about a time in which they ostracized someone, and the aim here was to make them feel guilty or immoral.
Okay.
Meanwhile, a control group wrote personal essays about a routine memory, nothing painful, just a memory. And the researchers instructed both the immoral volunteers and the control group to hold their hands in a bucket of ice water for as long as they could stand it, and others dipped their hands in a soothing bucket of warm water. So the question is, would immoral test subjects punish themselves with longer dips in the cold water? The individuals who just had to write a personal essay about a time that they were awful, would they feel better afterwards? And the answer ends up being yes on both counts. Those who were primed to feel shame about past actions dipped their hands in the cold water for longer durations, and they described the dip as more painful and expressed reduced feelings of guilt afterwards. So Brock Bastian argues that this experiment illustrates our culturally altered understanding of pain. We've come to process it not only as negative environmental feedback, but as justice and punishment. So on a psychological level, a little bit of self-inflicted pain rebalances the scales.
Mm-hmm. I would say on one hand, this is the kind of like intuition-confirming social psychology research that always makes me think, like, I'd like to see that replicated, a few times.
Yeah.
But assuming that the results hold up, that is interesting that, like, that pain would have this effect on our self-critical judgments, which also, of course, gives another explanation of why self-infliction of pain rituals might be so common in certain religious orders, especially people who take sins of the flesh very seriously.
Yeah. We see and read about an example of self-flagellation in Umberto Eco's The Name of the Rose.
Yes.
And, of course, in the movie adaptation, the girl is played by the same actor who would play a Cenobite in the fourth Hellraiser movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So there's your vital Umberto Eco Hellraiser connection.
I love it. Okay. A few more things mentioned in this study. So one thing they say is that pain – there's some evidence that pain, quote, brings cognitive resources online. So it helps increase our cognitive affective control of ourselves.
Okay. That lines up.
They say that this one was interesting and we hinted at it earlier. They say that pain enables identity management. And one example they give here is that physical pain in the body can sometimes interrupt what the authors call, quote, high-level awareness of a symbolically mediated, temporally extended identity. In other words, the kind of thinking about oneself that leads to negative, repetitive introspection, worry, self-consciousness, that physical pain increases awareness of the immediate physical body and decreases the immediate salience of these kinds of worries, the negative introspection about oneself and this horrible symbolic entity known as a person.
Mm-hmm. Tied up in this idea of a soul, yeah. Which really we should thank the Cenobites for tearing the soul apart. Like in the movie, it comes off as more of this threat, right? I'm going to tell you, we're going to tear your soul apart. Well, really we should be saying thank you. That's the kind of ego loss I've been searching for. That's why I picked up the lament configuration.
Right. That's how you finally achieve the higher state of consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay, and a couple of other things they mentioned. This one I think is pretty straightforward, but it's true. Pain can be interpreted as demonstrating virtue, such as courage, toughness, dedication. The symbolic value of withstanding pain can sometimes override the physical discomfort of the pain itself.
Though at the same time, worth pointing out, that's a great way to wind up in that third category of injured if you were just, right, you know, like, yeah, I'm too masculine, you know, I'm too powerful to listen to the pain signal. Well, now you have the injury and damage signal, and you have to deal with that.
Right. Yes. And they also note several ways in which it appears that pain promotes affiliation between people. You know, they say the expression of pain can sometimes increase empathy and care for others, and that expressions of pain can trigger social connections, and they can strengthen bonding and solidarity.
And in the later, you know, Hellraiser movies, this holds true, right? Because once the Cenobites are done with you, like, you are one of them.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Now, I do want to stress on a briefly serious note that while we're talking about these possibly recognized psychological benefits of different kinds of pain, we should stress that none of the potential benefits of pain should be interpreted as excuses to continue practices of actual self-injury, you know, meaning like the deliberate damaging of your body tissues, such as cutting or burning. If you are practicing self-injury or considering it, including, of course, non-suicidal self-injury, this is not something to deal with on your own. This is something that's important to talk to people about, talk to friends or family members or a mental health professional if at all possible. There are other ways to get relief from the underlying issues that lead to this coping mechanism, and they're far less dangerous.
Absolutely. Now, on the same note, you know, we do have listeners who have, you know, taken part in BDSM. We've also heard from listeners who have done hook suspension. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important to note, like, these are avenues that one should, you know, enter into with safety in mind. And also, if you go into any of these things, you know, safety is going to be a part of those ventures, like how to essentially utilize pain without leading to that area of damage, of injury, or certainly infection. Mm-hmm. So certainly do your research. It's also worth stressing that some levels of physical pain, though pain's not always the right word, can certainly be acquired through exercise.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I just want to say, one of the studies I was looking at, though it was very clear to say that I think at the time exercise had not been found to be like an empirically reliable way of curing self-injury pattern behavior, mm-hmm. That anecdotally it was often reported by patients that exercise had been substituted
self-injury. Yeah, I would say that, like, basically if you were inspired by anything you heard here and you want to try something, well, first of all, the cold water, I think, is a great avenue to consider. But also, yeah, just, you know, most levels of exercise, you know, you hear about, like, feeling the burn, right? You know, experiencing some level of discomfort during a workout and perhaps the soreness that you would experience in the following 48 hours. Like, you know, I think that's an area where one might pursue some of what we're talking about.
And that comes with a lot of added benefits for your life and your mental health as well.
Right. Yeah. And if you're doing it right, yeah, you're not injuring yourself in the process. Like, so much of what we're talking about, like, it really resonates with my own yoga practice. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, that I can feel myself, you know, putting myself into this level of discomfort, staying clear of the area of injury, and in doing so, like, feeling this heightened state of existence, you know? Like, I feel more in tune with my body and my surrounding and with the people in the room with me that are also engaging in this practice, that are also experiencing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say, yeah, don't do what Pinhead does.
Right.
Go to a yoga studio instead.
Well, I would be curious, in your yoga practice, do you find the reduction of the negative aspects of self-introspection and the ability to self-regulate your identity processes through the discomfort brought about in yoga?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's one of the main reasons I do it, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Maybe I got to give yoga a try one of these days.
Well, you got to give it more than one try, because I hated it the first time I did it.
Is there anywhere in town that does, like, horror yoga, like horror-themed yoga?
There's a – our former co-host, Christian, would go to a death metal yoga.
Yeah, I've heard of that. It's not the same.
Yeah, you want a full horror-themed yoga.
I want pumpkinhead yoga.
Pumpkinhead yoga. Yeah, I don't know. There's so many forms of yoga. I feel like there is room for that brand of yoga as well.
Okay, I think we may have done it for pain here, but I think we could briefly talk about skinless critters. Do you want to do that?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. Frank in the film spends a lot of time skinless. You know, he comes back as this shriveled corpse, and then he's able to drink enough blood to regenerate, but then he needs to acquire a new skin.
He keeps thinking he's going to get skin, but then he never – like one victim after another, he's like, he's got to have skin this time. He's almost there, and then still no skin.
Right. And in the second movie, which I have not seen in a long time, but I remember as being fun. And grotesque.
I don't know if I remember fun. But
I remember
okay.
fun.
But basically, it's like it's Ernest goes to hell. They go to hell.
No, it's not. Well, they go to hell, yes. But I don't think it's quite an Ernest movie. in that film, we encounter Frank again, and we encounter Julia.
Right.
And Julia now also is skinless and has to acquire a skin. And at one point, she's able to slip away by sort of, being like sort of leaving her skin behind, shedding her skin. And it is interesting to then look to the natural world and see that we do see a practice like this as a defense mechanism in certain organisms. We've talked about autotomy before on the show, the amazing biological ability to shed part of one's body to facilitate escape from a predator. Mm-hmm. The most classic example being a lizard shedding its tail.
Right. Yeah, you sort of give the predator a consolation prize.
Yeah, or a distraction. There are a few different interpretations of it, right?
It's a compromise. It gets the tail. You get to survive.
But there are also two species of African spiny mice that slouch off portions of their furry flesh when they're grabbed by a predator.
Ugh.
It's one thing to see this in a lizard, but here's a mammal that does it, and it's flesh. It's not a limb that it's going to regrow. It's just a big portion of its skin that pulls aside.
Oof.
So I saw explained in Nature, these self-flaying mice simply slip out of portions of their own hide and rapidly regrow complete suits of hair follicle, skin, sweat glands, fur, and even cartilage to fill in the gaps. And we see some of that regenerative power in Julia Cotton in Hellraiser 2. But Frank, he'd never seemed to have quite learned that ability on his own. No, he had to steal his brother's skin. Mm-hmm. Now we find another skilled skin shucker, if you will, in the form of a particular gecko species from Madagascar. These are fish-scaled geckos. I'm going to attempt the species name. This is when we need Mark Mandinka in the studio, but it's Geckolepis megalepis. And basically they have these giant kind of oversized looking fish scales on their body, and basically if something tries to capture them, they shed the skin. And it actually makes it difficult to study them because researchers have to collect specimens with special cotton-based traps, and even these are not quite delicate enough to prevent injury. Like they'll basically shed some of their skin at the drop of a hat.
It's a bummer. You need to find a way to calm them down before you catch them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but basically they're like, I don't want to be caught, period.
Right.
Yeah. So they're a lot like Frank in that situation. Frank does not want to be recaptured by the centipedes. And of course, not only are these different animals, the mice and the geckos, not only are they interesting in their own right, this is another one of those areas, as with, you know, lizards regrowing their tails and other regenerative powers in nature, like there is a potential here to figure out how to employ regenerative medical technology in humans down the line.
Like salamander research.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So, you know, we could reach the I don't know about regrowing a human's complete skin, but certainly we're getting into that area of possibility. But the skin comes off really easily in Hellraiser. I don't know if you've noticed this in a lot of horror films. There are two things that happen way too easily. First of all, someone can be impaled on something super easily.
Yeah.
And then also a person's entire skin can be pulled off, you know, with relative ease.
Oh, as far as impaling and stabbing and stuff goes, horror movies seem to forget that people have bones. You ever notice that?
Yeah.
It's like where are the bones?
Somebody trips and a table leg all the way through the body. Like just straight through all the bones in the chest, through the heart, everything, as if the human body is made out of balsa wood.
Robert, this has been mighty fun to discuss today, but I notice hooks and chains emerging from the studio walls to us away.
That's the sign that we have to call it there. Obviously, we could continue to talk about the nature of pain here. So, hey, if you want more, check out some of our past episodes on pain. And I'm sure we'll come back around to pain in the future. There are a number of things we've touched on here that we could flesh out in a future episode.
Pun intended.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, when you're talking Hellraiser, all puns are intended. So in the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes, where can you find them? Well, you can find them at stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's our website. You can also find them wherever you get your podcasts. And hey, if you're on that thing they call Facebook, you can find the Facebook group for Stuff to Blow Your Mind. It's the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. That's a fun place to interact with other listeners and occasionally the hosts themselves.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, this is Seth hopping in real quick just to say a quick thank you to Annie Reese for providing the voice of our Cenobite in the beginning there, the lead Cenobite, the proto-Pinhead. If you want to hear more from Annie doing awesome things with her voice, you should listen to her podcasts. That's Minty, Stuff Mom Never Told You, and Savor. All this month, just like we're doing our Halloween-themed episodes, they're doing their Halloween-themed episodes, and they're all really great. There's some stuff on female monsters, the feminism of the Alien franchise, female serial killers, the Winchester House, let's see, apple cider, the turnip. Do you know turnips were the original jack-o'-lanterns? Just saying. These are all really cool things that you will learn if you go listen to Annie on her other podcasts, Sminty and Savor. Go do that, everyone. All right, back to you, Joe.
If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.